All too often, pain in ridden horses is labeled as bad behavior. The apparently sound horse is naughty, lazy, difficult, explosive, spooky, nappy, and more. These labels are wrong. Pain impacts all aspects of a horse's performance, including its partnership with the rider and its potential to progress. It does not always create lameness. Relieving pain can lead to greater potential, a deeper partnership, and improved performance. In the recently published book, Harmonious Horsemanship, Use of the Ridden Horse Ethogram to Optimize Potential Partnership and Performance, Sue Dyson and Sue Palmer share their professional knowledge and experience. Check it out. It can be bought from Troubadour Book Publishing or Amazon.
Welcome to Conversations in Equine Science. My name is Kate Acton and I'm joined by Nancy McLean, and this is the podcast where we take equine research and try and make it accessible to horse owners and enthusiasts alike. Remember that with each topic we discuss, it's important to get professional advice before implementing any of the strategies.
This week, Nancy and I are discussing a paper that's titled Used Like Pawns or Treated Like Kings: How Narratives Around Racehorse Welfare in the 2023 Grand National May Affect Public Acceptance, an Informed Commentary. And this paper is written by Gemma Pearson, Jeanette Douglas, Inga Wolfram, and Tamsin Furtado. And it is open access, I believe, and was published on the 8th of October. So very new, some great commentaries. I'm going to read the simple summary to give you guys an overview. And then at the end, Nancy and I have a little update as well. That's come to light within days of this paper being published. So in the simple summary, the Grand National is one of the world's most famous steeplechase races. In 2023, the start of the race was delayed as an animal rights group protested about the race by gaining access to the race course. When the race eventually took place, several horses fell, with one sustaining a fatal injury. The ensuing commentary from racing aficionados and animal activists alike laid bare some of the fundamental issues surrounding the sport. This event highlights how the racing industry is increasingly subject to public pressure around the safety and welfare of horses. Public acceptance of activities such as racing is known as social license to operate, SLO. And as societies and cultures evolve, so too does the concept of this social license. For example, the SLO around circus animals has largely been lost, while zoos have managed to maintain their SLO through shifting their focus towards education and the conservation of wild animals. Following the 2023 Grand National, pro and anti-racing groups shared their views on a variety of media platforms. And in this commentary, the authors consider how these narratives that have been presented might shape the future of the racing industry. So a really excellently written paper that looks at both sides. It felt very equal and unbiased in its approach. So I thought from that point of view, that was great, like to just highlight what can be done, what is being done, and what we need to focus on.
Yeah, and this was such a great paper because this, you know, is about the Grand National that, what was it, in April, Kate?
Yeah.
When it goes off. But this explains the racing industry currently in the United States. We're probably at an all-time low for attendance at the event. We're slowly losing our SLO to operate. And it's just because I think both sides, whether it's the welfare groups or the I guess the fans, and then the horsemen. You've got those three entities, and it's just like there's no intermingling of independent opinions. It's whatever side you're on, that's what you want. There's no compromise. And I think, as a whole, you have to engage with different viewpoints. And I think we as horsemen have to accept that change is inevitable and you can't be so resistant to it. And it's a great read. I can tell you the, I guess, the way the protesters held up the start of the race, it does make a horse very nervous. And because they're used to a routine, and sometimes in American racing, a horse will, won't go into the gate, or it will flip in the gate or lay down under the gate. And then that's a delay. And I cannot tell you how upsetting that is to the other horses, especially if they're young horses. And so that disruption of the normal routine can create havoc during the race once it eventually starts. So I can empathize with the horsemen blaming the protesters for, the outcome of the race and due to the delay that it created. But I can also see the protesters' point of view that they were trying to stop the race from happening to try and prevent any fatalities. So, you can see both sides, but sometimes your choice of how to handle a situation actually endangers the horses more. What do you think of that, Kate? Because I didn't talk to you about that before we started and how a routine disruption can really affect the horses.
Yeah, I loved reading that in this paper because I think I came in with preconceived notions and like I have a bias in this. And reading this paper really made me understand both sides a little bit better. Like some of those horses were unsaddled and then were resaddled in that time period. It was about 15 minutes that the race was held up. And that does have an effect on those animals. Like, they're all geared up. They know this routine. They know it's race day. They have all of this energy. And then to be standing around for 15 minutes to have their saddle taken off, that would be very confusing to them. There is an impact. They said having to bring the horses back to the holding area. Like all these things do have an impact. And it is during a risky sport, So if you were thinking about humans doing a high risk, like I suppose race car driving or something, and you imagine throwing off their routine, like straight away you can empathize that that could end up having a huge impact on how they race and their welfare when they race. So it was really good to actually see that in there for me. It gave me a good perspective of how it feels to be on the other side of that. And also how they said that everyone in the racing industry, the majority are coming from a place of a huge love for these animals. And it's people's livelihoods and people have great pride in it. And it is about trying to bridge that gap and making this more, I suppose, of a safer race. And I know when we talked about it some months back, I remember saying, like, my stance is that if we're going to compete horses, we need to compete them to their best of their abilities and not be asking them to do the impossible. And that's what's resulting in injuries a lot of the time. And in the Grand National, I suppose to give everyone a little bit of a background, the Grand National is a steeplechase. It is a course that is 4 miles, 500 and 514 yards. So that's about 6.9 kilometers. And there's 30 jumps throughout that course. It is very iconic. In the paper, they say that frequently the television audiences exceed 7.5 million, and that's just in the United Kingdom where this is held. And a lot of people attend the race as well. So there is a huge audience there and a lot of pressure. And talking about this social license to operate, that was the first time that I'd heard about a social license to operate, and it kind of made it clearer to me how, I suppose, the people have a voice in what is okay and what isn't okay, and why in some countries certain races have been banned. So jump racing isn't legal in all countries, and there's parts of Australia where it's banned. And it's about, I suppose, what the authors were really looking at is saying, you know, if the race industry in the UK wants this to continue in a safe and animal welfare friendly way, they need to do it in a way where they're loud about it. Like, they just need to make it clear we are making changes. Like, we have heard you and we are making changes. And that makes a big difference to your social license to operate and that public opinion. You know, we understand you're saying that times have changed and we need to now, I suppose, meet those requirements. And just to give you guys, I suppose, a brief update, we'll go into it further. But this paper came out on the 8th of October, and on the 12th of October, the Grand National has actually come out and explained what changes they're going to implement in April. Not that this paper was the cause of that, but that's how close the two are. So as we talk through the paper, some of you may already be aware that some changes have been brought into place, and we'll talk about that at the end, because it was just within days of each other that these came to light. So in this, I thought what was another really interesting point was just, again, how we can lead those changes. So one way they explained this, which I just thought made it really clear, like a simple analogy, is McDonald's was taking a lot of heat from the public that they weren't being environmentally friendly. They had a lot of heat from animal rights groups as well about sourcing of the meat and all these things. And what they did was they actually sought out expert advice, and they got people to collaborate with them from environmentalist groups and from animal activists and welfare groups, and they came up with a plan on how they were going to be more friendly, and they really protected their brand in doing that. So I thought that was really fascinating. Like, it's not to say that we need to get rid of a certain sport. We just need to make more updates and be more open with what's going to be changed and how we're using the data is the most important thing, and using what scientific information we have about what is best for these horses and implementing that to inform our decisions.
Yeah, and I wanted to add that sometimes they have around 40 competitors in the Grand National. Now, over here in this country, the Kentucky Derby is sometimes around 20 competitors or 20 horses. So, I mean, when you're going over 30 jumps and that distance and you're packed together close, that is a lot of horses. In a herd running so close to one another, and not even on the flat doing jumps as well. But I thought one of the best graphics in this paper, first off, in all the research papers I've ever looked at, I've never seen a graphic abstract. And I thought this was so good. They've got a picture of a red road and a green road. And then they've got all these signs that the red road, of course, leads to, the sport being out of business or no longer. It goes into the history books. And then the green road leads to a good outcome. Both sides come together, reach an agreement. They consider the welfare of the horse. They get more attendees and more support from the public. So then when you go into the charts, they're either green or they're red. So you know the red stipulations or outcomes are going to be because the industry failed to make those changes and, you know, didn't include all the stakeholders and their requirements in their new rulings or in their changes. So they kind of ignored there's a problem. So I love it that the actions taken by the racing industry in the Green Road was to prioritize equine welfare in both actions and words. So just don't say you're going to do something. Actually, let the public see and know you're doing it. And number two was to demonstrate shared values with the public regarding equine welfare. So not just say they're treated like kings, but to actually demonstrate that, maybe when they're at the track, especially because they're always talking about horses are such well taken care of away from the track or away from the competition area, but they never say anything about the track conditions or the course conditions. And then to be transparent about welfare issues is very important. There's a lot of people stick their head in the sand and don't want to acknowledge there are welfare concerns. I mean, back in the 40s, we didn't know what we know now about horses. So now we know to do different and we have to embrace that. And then the last one is abides by external rules and enforces internal rules relating to welfare. So not only to just be following your own internal rules, but you've got to consider what the social license to operate, the public is dictating to you what they want to see. And then your outcome will be the public will trust the racing industry. And then the media will be largely supportive and not always running to report on these tragic breakdowns. So then your social license to operate gets public acceptance, no pressure on politicians then to regulate, and then self-regulation will grow and remain in place. So I thought that was brilliant to do a graphic abstract.
Yeah, it's no, but it was so easy to follow on the paper as well.
So, and then your figure two following that had the red and green. I mean, just a very well put together paper, and it is open access. So it's on with animals. So I just thought it was easy to follow, even if you just look at the graphs and the figures.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned about the number of horses. The Grand National actually has said, I believe, I've seen it from a secondary source, not directly from them, but that the reason why they keep the number of horses high in the race is actually to control the speed, because when you have that many horses, they can't go as fast, and it could potentially be a more dangerous race with fewer horses. But I mean, we could mitigate some of those. I mean, if you have fewer horses, take out some of those jumps or like make other changes. So I don't know when it comes to that, that is one of the updates they've made is in regards to the number of horses that run, but they have said that it is almost like a part of a safety thing, having a larger number of horses. So that's probably a little bit up for debate. With this paper as well, actually, what was interesting is they mentioned how research is now moving at a pace to analyze data relating to the jump race risk model. So that's a project that aims to determine the risk factors for injury in jump racing thoroughbreds. And they did point out that the Grand National specifically has extensive analysis of the data around risk factors for falls. From this, some of their fences have been lowered or modified. The distance to the first jump has been reduced. The going is carefully monitored and modified if necessary. The jockeys are briefed regarding speed to the first fence, and the minimum age for horses to compete has been increased. And there have been changes to the horse and jockey entry criteria. And where they've made changes, they have a little graph as well of the races that have taken place and then races where there have been injuries or fatalities. Specifically looking at the fatalities in figure one, there, once they made some changes in 2012, there were a couple of years where there were no fatalities. So you can see where they are listening to the data and implementing the data. It does have an effect. And I just thought that was really interesting too. Like, you know, to point out that they are, it's not that they're sitting back and not making any changes. They are the whole time making these small changes. But I guess it's about that thing of like communicating that to people, that they are looking into it, that they're not, I suppose, just turning a blind eye to the public outcry at the moment in regards to it. And the actually, like, using in this paper, they use one of the trainers as an example where, let me just double check her name again. I want to make sure I get this right.
I think she was the winner this year, wasn't she?
Yes, Lucinda Russell, that was it. So yes. They wanted to point out a really good example of practice is when they talk about, like, if you're going to talk the talk, you have to walk the walk, and that someone who does that is Lucinda Russell. So she was trainer of the 2023 Grand National winner, Cora Grambler. And Russell declined the opportunity to parade the horse at other race fixtures after his win, saying that he was now very clearly on his holidays. And on her social media, she shared pictures of him in the field with another horse. And they mention in this paper, me and Nancy have talked about this so many times, the three Fs, so forage, friends, and freedom. And in this instance, she's showing people that he is getting his three Fs. He's getting his welfare needs met, his socialization needs, like everything that we need for a happy, healthy horse. And I just thought that was really great to kind of set that example, because there are a lot of racehorses that unfortunately aren't turned out in herds. It is great that more and more are getting pasture time. I think it's something people are becoming more aware of. But there are some that don't get these basic welfare needs, and that needs to be addressed as well. Because the commentators, a lot of the time in the racing industry, will say, as Nancy said, that these horses are treated like kings. You know, like they have the most incredible lives. They're pampered when they're off the race course. But our idea of pampering may not necessarily be meeting the three Fs, is the first thing to consider. And the second, you know, what the people were crying out for was for someone to address what was happening to them on the racetrack. And the commentators diverting to saying their life off the racetrack is great is not only not addressing the question, but it's almost like highlighting that there's a potential issue that they're skirting around. Like, oh, well, never mind when they're on the track, when they're off it, you know, it's, they have the best time. So I just thought that was really interesting as well. And it was great that that standard is being set by the winning trainer. You know, like, no, I'm not going to parade him around the race fixtures. I'm going to make a point of, he's now on his holidays, he's now getting all his needs met. And you can tell that's something that's really valued.
Yeah, that, I thought that was a great illustration too, to others, maybe to follow suit. And I really picked up on a term I had never heard before, but it's avoiding whataboutery. And it's so pertinent because we always want to point the finger at other branches of the equine industry instead of, say, the racing industry. And an example of whataboutery was the commentators kept talking about, it's a shame that the protesters do not stand by a roadside or a field and point to ill-kept horses, you know, thin horses, horses that are not visibly being taken care of. But that is just deflecting the criticism from the original target. And it's kind of like telling the public, we might be bad, but they're worse. So it's like two kids fighting, you know?
Yeah. So, you know what? Like, this always kind of got me in practice, because for we have really overweight animals, that is just as much of a welfare issue as underweight animals. But there's different perceptions. You know, people see an underweight animal and they're a lot more ready to be vocal about it. Whereas people see an overweight animal and just think that they're indulging in more luxuries, like that this is okay, not ideal that they're overweight, but, you know, they're happy or they're getting what they want or we're treating them or it's nice. Like, there's all these things tied in around that that seem to be more positive than if a horse was underweight, it would very clearly be like, what is happening here? Like, something needs to change. So I just think there is a double standard. You can have a horse that looks like it's doing well and its welfare needs are not being met. Like, those two things are possible to happen together.
Yep. And I kind of got some of that from my sister was on me for putting that grazing muzzle on my pony. She thought it was cruel.
I was like,
the thing that's really cruel is metabolic disorders that come up with horses because of obesity. So, you know, sometimes it's just maybe not being so defensive about what you're doing, but being more communicative about why you're doing it this way. And I think too, sometimes people with a differing opinion can help maybe make us look at things a little bit different as well. Now, I still have the grazing muzzle on the pony. Because, I mean, she has to. She just gains too much weight, and that's so unhealthy. But, you know, that's a good point you made, Kate, because sometimes people feel so strongly about their viewpoints that they can't see the forest for the trees. There, you know, sometimes we get so offended, and I think it's time we do have to kind of look at what's best for the horse and not make excuses. That's what I think I really want to say, is sometimes we're guilty of making excuses.
Absolutely. And I, like, I'll put my hands up and say, in the past, I definitely would have had an idea of how something was and would have at times maybe been stubborn about thinking that was the right course of action. And what made a big difference to me is the more you read, the more you listen to people discussing research, whether it's in humans or horses or dogs or cats or wherever your interest lies, the more you learn, the more you become open to the fact that things change and update and we can learn more. And I've mentioned it in a couple of podcasts episodes, but if you are open to feedback, it doesn't feel like an attack, or should feel less so in the beginning and then won't feel like it eventually. And the more you're open to feedback and open to, you know, asking the vet, like, is this right? Like, I've always done this. Is this correct? Or asking an expert, like having a nutritionist have a look at what you're doing. You know, should I keep doing this or should I update what I'm doing? It feels less like criticism. And then you're actually using informed data to be able to move forward and to make the best decisions.
That is so well said. I completely agree. You know, so I think that's a good note to end on. And, you know, I just hope that the America can get its act together for its racing industry. Otherwise, I think eventually it'll, you know, cease to exist. And that's unfortunate because these animals are absolutely stunning and majestic and so talented and very, very smart. I mean, sometimes they're smarter than the trainers who train them. So.
Yeah. And I will just end on the note that the updates the Grand National has brought into place is they have looked at that data that they have. They realized that the cruising speed of the national participants has increased over the years as a result of better horses taking part. So that first fence will be moved 60 yards closer to the start in an attempt to reduce the field speed in the early stages. The track will also implement a standing start in all races over the national fences, including those at course meetings in November and December. And some of the other adjustments to the track and conditions include a reduction in the height of the 11th fence by 2 inches. So it's coming from 5 foot down to 4'10", and a rise in the minimum rating required for runners to qualify from 125 to 30. And there'll also be an end to the formal parade with the horses led by the handlers, with riders instead cantering the horse in front of the stands before turning near the chair fence and going to the start.
Wow. Well, hats off to them for making those changes and doing it so quickly.
There's also a couple other little ones about just the timing of the race starting and to do with ground conditions. You can have a Google and look up all those changes that they're bringing into place. But I suppose the big one is they are bringing it from 40 horses down to 34. So that's a 15% reduction in the number of horses that will race.
Yeah, that's really I really admire them for stepping up. And now see, that makes the public feel like, okay, things are getting better. And, you know,
yeah, and like they're valuing the point, because I think mm-hmm. it just looks so bad if someone raises a concern about horse welfare and a huge horse organization doesn't make any comments on that. You know, or any comments on correcting it if it's not the case, or making corrections if it is the case.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is really, you know, a good way to handle things in all equine sports from here on out. I think they had a graph even of the how not listening to the public ended up. Now we don't have the pentathlon in the Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a cost to pay for, you know, ignoring what the public is telling you and what is popular with them. And welfare is a big topic. I mean, back in the day when you used animals for entertainment, people went along with it and didn't really question because the research wasn't there. And as yeah. we know, we should do better.
And it's interesting how this social license to operate can have such a large impact.
Yep. Yeah. So, well, I hope everyone enjoyed this article. It's not just on racing, though. I think, as I said, it can apply to all aspects of equine endeavors. And, you know, we got to keep it in the back of our heads. People are watching. So, yeah. No, we've got to be accountable and respectful towards our horses. So, Kate, did you have anything else?
No, I think that was everything. Really great paper that looks at both sides, open access. So highly recommend it for a read.
Yeah, I've just got one update to make. I had a message from Christine. She is a thoroughbred owner and breeder in California. And she has a connection with a researcher that has just gotten new research published on the microbiome of the horse and oxidative stress. And she sent the paper to me, which I'm going to get it to Kate. And we may talk about it because as this paper is now showing that the higher the oxidative stress is, it affects bone strength in horses.
Oh.
So it should be an interesting read. It is a long, long paper. So Kate and I may start to read it now, but maybe not do an episode on it for a while until we've digested it all. But she's also might come on the an episode and talk with us about it. So we'll kind of keep everyone posted because it is new research. And I think they've got two papers out now. So definitely tying it in with metabolic issues. And it seems like as horses age, and I hear every day about another horse diagnosed with metabolic syndrome or PPID or some form of an inflammatory type disease. So it should be some interesting reading, and look for that episode coming up. And then also go back to our episode from July on our equine athletes happy. It kind of applies to what we talked about today.
Brilliant. That sounds fascinating. We touched on the microbiome before, so that would be great to get an update and get some more information on it.
Okay, Kate. Well, so glad to have you back, and we'll talk next week.
Thanks so much, Nancy. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.